Chapter 13. A Reunion. War Bells. The long, slow task begins. I don't know if I did convince the Inquisitor General. I don't know if I could. But she heard me out and stayed around for another 2 hours, helping to locate the files of connected cases and other materials. Past 9, she was called away to a disturbance on an island community in the Caducades. Before she left, she offered accommodation for me and my staff in the Minster, which I politely declined, and made it clear that I had her permission to continue my investigation in Khazad-dûrth, provided I kept her informed.
"I've heard stories about your adventures, Eisenhorn. I don't want anything like that happening on my turf. Do we understand each other?"
"We do."
"Good night, then. And good hunting."
Fischig and I were left alone in the archivum. "You were wrong," I told him.
"How's that?"
"I did like her."
"Ha! That hard-nosed bitch!"
"Actually, I liked her because she was a hard-nosed bitch. I always took pleasure in meeting a fellow inquisitor who conducted their work fairly and seriously, even if their methods differed from mine. Neve was a thoroughbred Puritan and lacked patience. She was abrupt to the point of rudeness. She was overworked, but she called things as she saw them, despised sloppiness, and took the threats to our society and way of life completely seriously. In my opinion, there was no other way for an inquisitor to behave." We worked on until midnight, studying and collating the contents of hundreds of case files. By then, the gun cutter had arrived from the landing fields at Khazad Tyrok in response to my Vox summons. Fischig found one of Neve's rubricators and charged him with making data slate copies of the most promising files ready for our return in the morning. Then we got back into the speeder and flew through the Castellum's zigzag streets to the town field. The stars were out, and it was cool. Noctule moths fluttered around the landing lights of the waiting cutter. There was a mauve smudge in the night sky, down low over the eastern horizon. The rising nebula of the Eye of Terror. Even from this great distance, just a blur in the heavens, it put a chill into me. If the two-headed eagle symbolizes all that is good and noble and right about the Imperium of Mankind, that rancid blur symbolized all that was abominable about our eternal foe. Laughter and warm voices greeted Fischig as we went aboard. Amos shook him repeatedly by the hand, and Beckwin planted a quick kiss on his cheek that made him blush. He exchanged a few playful put-downs with Nail and Medea, and asked Husman if he was hungry.
"Why?" the scout hunter asked, his eyes widening in anticipation.
"Because it's supper time," said Fischig. "Betancourt, get this crate into the air."
We were going to that safe place he had mentioned. I had not been aboard the Sprint Trader SN for some 5 years. A classic Isolde pattern bulk clipper, the ship was like a space-going cathedral, 3 kilometers long, and looked as majestic holding low anchor above Cadia as it had when I first saw it, nearly 100 years before, in the cold orbit of Hubris. Medea coasted us in towards the cargo hatch of the gigantic craft.
"A rogue trader?"
asked Inchabel cautiously, looking over my shoulder at the ship ahead. "An old friend," I reassured him. Shipmaster Tobias Maxilla was, I suppose, my most unlikely ally. He'd made his living shipping luxury goods officially, and unofficially, along the space lanes of the Helicon subsector. He still did. He was a merchant, he maintained, to any that asked. But he had a pirate's taste for adventure, a yearning for the halcyon days of early spacefaring. I had hired his ship during the affair of the Necrotuque, to provide nothing more than transport for my team, but he had got involved, with increasing glee, and he'd stayed involved ever since. Every few years over the last century, I had hired him to run passage for me or some of my staff, or he had contacted me to ask if his services were needed, just because he was bored, just because he was in the neighbourhood. Maxilla was an educated, erudite man, with a subtle wit and a taste for the finest things in life. He was also a charming host and a good companion, and I liked him immensely. He was in no way a formal part of my staff, but he was, I suppose, after all this time and all those shared adventures, a vital part. The year before, when it had been decided that Fischig would embark on this long chase after the Cadian leads, I had asked Maxilla to provide him with transportation for as long as it was needed. He had agreed at once, and not because of the generous fee I was offering. To him, it sounded like a true adventure.
Besides, it promised a chance to give the old SN a proper long run out, beyond its normal route of the Helican stars. A genuine voyage, an odyssey. That was what Tobias Maxilla lived for. He was waiting in the cargo hold to greet us, even before the extractor vents had finished dumping out the cutter's thruster fumes. He had dressed for the occasion, as was his way. A blue velvet balmakan with huge sleeves and a jabot collar. A peascod doublet of Japanagar silk. Patent leather sabatons with gold buckles and a stupendous fantail hat perched on his powdered periwig. His face was skin-dyed white and set with an emerald beauty spot. His cologne was stronger than the thruster fumes.
"My dear, dear Gregor," he cried, striding forward and taking my proffered hands with both of his. "A signal joy to have you back aboard our humble craft."
"Tobias, a pleasure, as always."
"And dear Elizabeth, looking younger and more fragrant than ever."
He clasped her hand and kissed her cheek.
"Steady now, you'll smudge your makeup."
"Wise Amos, welcome, savant."
Amos just chuckled as his hand was shaken. I don't think he ever knew quite what to make of Maxilla.
"Mr. Nail!"
"Maxilla."
"And Medea, ravishing, quite ravishing."
"You certainly are," Medea said playfully, allowing one of her circuit-inlaid hands to be kissed.
"You knew we were coming, Maxilla. You might have smartened up a bit," said Fischig.
Amid laughter, they shook hands. I realized their relationship had changed. They had been together for a year on this mission. Fischig had never really connected with Maxilla. Their backgrounds and lives were too divergent. But clearly, a year in each other's company had brokered a true friendship at last. That pleased me, too. An Inquisitor's band works better when it is close-knit. Maxilla turned to Husman and Inchabel.
"You two I don't know, but I will, as that's what dinners are for. Welcome to the SN."
Maxilla's sculptural gold servitors, each one a work of art, had prepared a late supper for us in the grand dining lounge. A pâté zéphyr of crab, fresh from the caducades that morning, entolle flowers poivrées in their husks, fillets of Cadian boar en gras, followed by an ebon fruit talmousse with cream and Indian syrup. The gilded sommelier served petulant Samatan rosé, heavy-bodied Cadian claret, a sweet and sticky toque from a lowland kloss on Hydrofur, and stinging shots of Mordian schnapps. Our humours were good, and the impromptu supper gave us time to step back from the work at hand and relax. None of us spoke of the case or the demands that it was likely to make of us. To rest the mind often clears it. I was going to need clarity now. We returned to Cazet-Dirth the next morning in the guncutter. The steel dawn over the wide island group of the Caducades was cut by the rising edge of a burning red sun. As we swept in over the craggy mainland, the peaks and edges of the moors were caught with a pink alpenglow. Despite the fact that we were broadcasting the correct clearances, we were challenged 6 times in the half-hour descent. At one point, a pair of Cadian marauders rolled in and flanked us as they checked us over. Military security dominated the Cadian way of life. Every non-military transport, shuttle and starship, was placed under acute observation, especially those that behaved suspiciously or wandered from the authorized flight routes. Amos told me that a pinnace carrying the Deacon of Arnush, visiting Cadia for a promulgation seminar, had been shot down over the Sea of Kansk 6 months earlier, simply because it failed to give the correct codes. It made me wonder how our unknown foe had got his minions on and off Cadia. Unless, like us, he had an identity and a rank that easily turned aside routine security checks. We were diverted 60 kilometres west of Cazet-Dirth because a war was going on. The dawn light was filled with the flashes and light streaks of a mass rocket attack. 8 regiments of Cadian shock, just a few days away from shipping out to a tour of duty on one of the inner fortress worlds of the Cadian Gate, were staging a live firing exercise. We finally sat down on the Minster's launch pad over an hour late. The war bells in every tower and shatravi in the Khazar were ringing to signal that the roar of battle from the nearby plains and moors was just a practice. We divided our efforts. Fischig took Amos to the Minster's archivum to study the records we had ordered copied the night before and do further research. Beckwin, escorted by Husman, went to search the stacks of the Ecclesiarchy's records in the Apostolaeum. Inchabel and Nail visited the Administratum's catalogue of records. I went with Medea to the Ministry of Interior Defence. There are no Arbites on Cadia. A permanent state of martial law governs the world, and as a result, all civil policing duties are overseen by the Interior Guard, a sub-office of the Cadian Imperial Guard itself. In Khazad Dirth, the region's administrative capital, their headquarters is the Ministry of Interior Defence, a greystone donjon adjoining the fortress of the Martial Governor, right at the heart of Khazad Dirth. Members of the Interior Guard are chosen at random. Worldwide, one in every 10 soldiers recruited into the Cadian forces is transferred into the Interior Force at the end of basic and preparatory, whatever their achievements and promise. As a result, some of the most able troopers ever raised on this planet of warriors serve out their time on the home world itself, and Cadia boasts one of the most effective and skilled planetary defense forces of any imperial world. We were seen by a Colonel Ibbot, a powerful lean man in his 40s who looked like he should have been leading the charge into the Eye of Terror. He was courteous but mistrustful. We have no files on illegal or suspect immigration. Why is that, Colonel? Because it doesn't happen. The system does not permit it. Surely there are unfortunate exceptions. Ibbot, his grey and white camoed uniform, starched and pressed so sharply you could have cut yourself on the creases, steepled his fingers. All right, then, I said, changing tack. What if someone wanted to get onto the planet anonymously? How could that be managed?
It couldn't, he said. He wasn't giving at all. Every identity and visit purpose is logged and filed, and any infractions quickly dealt with.
Then I'll start with the files annotating those infractions. Resignedly, Ibbot showed us into a codifier room and assigned us a military clerk to take us through the records. We sorted and checked for about 3 hours, slowly becoming bored with the interminable lists of orbital boardings, airspace interceptions, and ground-based raids. I could tell that a thorough review of these records alone was going to take weeks. So that's what we did. We spent 10.5 weeks scouring the archives and catalogues of Khazad Dirth, working in shifts and living out of the quarters on the guncutter. Every few days, we returned to the SN for a little rest and reflection. It was the dead of winter by the time we were finished.